All right. Good afternoon. We're going to open up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government this morning. This afternoon is March 7th, 2017. Colleagues, today we're going to be hosting a public hearing on Senate Bill 5534 as it relates to the public employees retirement system. Mr. Co-Chair, thank you for helping us. Good seeing you.
Yeah, I see how it works now.
Yeah. And
he did open the meeting.
Open the public hearing.
Are we not? Oh, you want the public hearing open?
Did you? Oh, yeah. I got to stay for that.
All right. And we're now opening the public hearing on Senate Bill 5534.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
And why don't we do this? John, why don't you take a few minutes, go over some items for us, and then after that, we'll turn it over to Steve to take it from there, if that's all right.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the subcommittee. I just wanted to point something out, and Julie's going to help us out for a minute. So if you recall with your subcommittee orientation, we talked about non-limited funds, and I just wanted to show you practically how that works for this particular agency. You know, PERS has a current service level budget of $11 billion. $97 million of that is the limited portion, and then about $11 million $10.9 million is the non-limited portion. This happens to be the governor's budget bill that comes over, so it shows $109 million with policy packages that are limited. That's this Section 1. But then Section 2 doesn't have a dollar amount, and so I just wanted to take a minute and kind of explain the non-limited one more time since it's so significant for this agency. So the general protocol of the legislature is to limit funds. So Section 1 does that for the agency operations. They can spend no more than whatever the dollar amount that finally is in that Section 1 that comes out of the legislative session. Section 2 defines the specific purposes for which non-limited funds can be used, but doesn't specify the dollar amount. So the legislature, by not specifying the limit in Section 2, essentially delegates that authority to one of the other branches of government to make adjustments to that. But it's given certain specific parameters. One is, you know, the program would have to be authorized in statute. Two is it would have to have a stable source of revenue. Three is that the expenditures generally fluctuate or outside of agency control. And the fourth is that they're for routine expenditures rather than extraordinary. So this is a significant grant of authority. There's about five or six major state agencies that have large amounts of non-limited funds. Others include, you know, unemployment insurance benefits, housing, veterans loans, liquor purchases, things like that. So this is how the agency's budget measure is structured. I just wanted to point that out so that you are familiar with the term non-limited as you work your way through the agency's budget presentation the next couple days. The last thing I would add is that these are significant expenditures. Again, $10 to $11 billion for this source of non-limited. But the smaller sources of non-limited are becoming have far less utility because of the fact that the legislature has now gone to annual sessions. Mm-hmm. So for agencies with small amounts of non-limited, the general tendency or the general trend is to put those towards limited expenditures because they have the ability to come into the legislature and make budget adjustments. So the LFO does have a brief out on our website that discusses non-limited if you want some more detail, but I just thought I'd give you a quick overview and also give you kind of some experience looking at the agency's budget bill in anticipation of when we get to work session. The work session will be framed around that Section 1 amount, although there will be discussions of the non-limited. The main change will be is what's the amount that will be put into Section 1. So thank you, co-chair and members of the subcommittee.
No, thank you. That's awesome.
Thank you, Julie. Any questions?
All right. That was awesome. That's a good 101 background for all of us. Sir, come on up. Welcome. I'm glad to have both of you back. How do you want to How do you want to do this, Steve? Why don't I just turn this over to you and you run with it for
sure.
Today?
As soon as I get my technology back. There we go. Thank you for your indulgence. For the record, I'm Steve Rogman. I'm the executive director of the Public Employee Retirement System. The presentation today is an overview of the agency and its operations. And so I've got the presentation in front of you. And up on the screen, we have quite a bit of information to cover as far as a number of pages, but I'll just try to hit the highlights as we go through. Today's an overview of PERS, which is a review of our history, our mission, vision, and core values, the key goals and performance measures that we strive to attain as we do our operations, and then our strategic plan focus areas. Day two is going to be a report of our budget priorities and our progress on completing our packages so far, reviewing of the budget notes reports from the prior biennium. The one we're in today, and then a little overview of the policy packages that we have provided to you. Thursday is going to be a look at what's called our preliminary earnings crediting report. Every year, the PERS board credits earnings from the prior calendar year. We report that to the legislature as required by statute. So we're bringing that report to you, and there's an issue there in relation to a allocation of the contingency reserve. So I'll go through some detail about what that reserve is and why that issue is arising in this context, in this cycle that we take through earnings for crediting for 2016. So, overview of the agency. The agency administers a tax-qualified government plan that provides retirement, death, disability benefits for more than 900 public employers, covering about 95% of Oregon's public employees. So we cover a wide range of public employers, not just the state, but also cities, counties, school districts, et cetera. We're governed by a five-person board of directors. Those five people are appointed by the governor. Three of them must be independent of PERS, meaning they're not PERS members, they're not PERS beneficiaries, they have no connection to the system, but they do have a professional background in business, finance, investing, something like that. Two members then are appointed based on their qualifications. One of those is a retired or active member from represented by a union. The other is a management person from the state government or an elected official from one of our constituent public employers. So we have a member rep, we have an employer rep, but then we have three independent directors. This is the new board structure that was put in 2003 when the legislature did a substantial reform of PERS, and we've been operating with this five-person board structure ever since that 2003 reform. We also administer a deferred compensation program called the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. The Oregon Savings Growth Plan is for state employees. All state employees are eligible to join that program, as well as select local governments that choose to come into the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. Local governments have an option of our plan or any number of other deferred compensation plans that they may choose to offer their employees. We also have a post-retirement health insurance program, and that is predominantly, although we'll go into more detail, that is predominantly a pass-through program. In other words, for our retired members, we negotiate for a set or a selection of health insurance policies which the members can choose to use. When they choose to use those, their premiums are paid either out of the benefits that we would pay to the member or if they need to supplement that with additional funds. The point about this health insurance, these health insurance programs, aside from some very small subsidies that we can go into in some detail if you want, they're funded by the participants. So it is not an obligation of the employer or the state to provide this health insurance. We just negotiate and create a selection of health insurance programs for people from which people can choose. and then pass through the premiums in facilitating the payment for those plans. Lastly, just to note, we are also the state's Social Security Compliance Program Administrator. So all public employers in Oregon, actually around the country, have a choice when they're created as to whether to participate in Social Security. So because so many obviously in Oregon have chosen to participate in Social Security, there's a function that we provide, which is to make sure we coordinate the education and compliance for those public employers. So that function not only touches all the PERS employers, but the few employers that are not in PERS still work with us on their Social Security compliance. So that's all of a one-person function that in our agency, because so much of it, of course, is driven by the federal government and the resources they have. But it is a responsibility that sits within our agency. A quick note on our organizational chart. So this is our organizational chart, which I've tried to put into effect once I became director of PERS, which is a little over 2 years ago. And it's a little different than the organizational chart that existed prior to the time I came, and I'll go through some of the key differences. But this is this chart represents how the organization is structured around the functions that my chief officers are responsible for. And this structure was reviewed and approved by DAS and by LFO this summer. We're working through the budget, actually the budget process of aligning to this organizational structure, so we're still trying to work out some of the details. But conceptually, this is the team I have working with me and the things for which they are responsible. So why I chose this structure, or why these chiefs have this accountability, is, as you'll see in further discussions about the agency, what we hold, what we try to do very clearly in the agency is make people accountable for specific areas of responsibility. And so the accountability for each of these areas is more clearly defined, I think, than it previously was before I was put in the director's chair. So, for example, one of the things I did in this lower left is create an operations division and assigned the deputy director role to oversee operations. Before, our organizational structure was split into a benefit payments division and a customer service division. And I had people in benefits payments that were providing customer service and people in customer service that were paying benefits. It just was a division that had never been fully fleshed out or thought through. So what we did was embark on an organizational design exercise to see whether and how we could combine those operations into basically a group that is responsible for everything that touches the member communication, the member education, the member engagement and application, the paying of benefits, all the things that actually help a member through the course of their employment and through the course of their relationship with PERS is all centered in this operations sleeve. Therefore, you don't have as many handoffs, you don't have a finger-pointing exercise or siloing where someone can say, well, that's, you know, our responsibility, and it goes so far, you have to pick that up with somebody over here. The responsibility for the members is all in one place. The next one over is the chief administration officer. That is the person responsible basically for the back office functions of the agency, and particularly our relationship with DAS. So much of what we as a state agency do has to coordinate, collaborate, be consistent with the directives of DAS. That person's responsibility is to make sure that we understand those directives and that we comply and work within those parameters, build the relationships with DAS so that our administration of the agency is successful. Technology serves a special key role in our agency, as you'll see. Many of our policy option packages are built around our technology and our capabilities because we have made a strategic decision that we will provide enhanced services through technology. We are ahead of many agencies that are instead saddled by their legacy technology systems. In 2003, when this new retirement system was created, we were successful in getting authorization to move forward with the technology conversion program. We did that through the course of 2004 through 2011 and are on a new technology platform. which has allowed us many efficiencies and effectiveness, but the responsibility for that technology officer is not only that crucial set of functionality that supports the operations, but also we have our own data center where we keep the information and the functionality that we perform within our own headquarters. So you'll see some of our policy option packages are related to that technology and how we can leverage that further.
So we've got a question here. Representative Gumberg.
Thank you, Co-Chair, and thank you, Director. Co-Chair, colleagues, I apologize if I sound like a broken record, but I have a question that I've been trying to pursue across all these different agencies. Mr. Director, my question is, you folks are currently carrying about $70 million in delinquent debt. Who on this organizational chart, or where in this organizational chart, is the responsibility for trying to recoup that money?
Co-Chair Smith, Representative Gomberg, that would rest with our Chief Administration Officer. Accounts receivables within his responsibility.
All right. Thank you.
Any follow-up?
Later on in the presentation. Thank you.
Okay. Let me ask an additional question on as we're looking at the organizational chart. I noticed there's no one with the title of Chief Finance Officer. Which position would that lie under?
Again, Co-Chair Smith, that's in that administration sleeve. That's where financial reporting sits. So financial reporting, accounting, again, so much of the back office work that we do and the connections, again, through DAS, or in our case, even Treasury, because so much of our money runs through Treasury, is all centralized in that administration office.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I could,
please,
just a follow-up now that I think about it. Just seems to me, looking over these different areas of responsibility, if there's $70 million out there, I'd like to see accounts receivable on the list rather than implied within additional responsibilities.
Co-Chair Smith, Representative Gomberg, we try to constrain space. So there's certain teams and functions that are not represented directly on this list.
All right, thank you.
I think where the good representative is going, and this may be unfair to you initially, but as we were starting this committee up, we collectively decided that watching and monitoring those accounts that are owing to the state was going to be a highest priority of this committee. And so one of the things we're going to be encouraging all entities under our purview to be doing is to highlight that and to recognize that account collection is a high priority. And so maybe in the future we could include that as a category there.
Sure, and Co-Chair Smith and Representative Gomberg, to your point, I wasn't aware it was a particular point of emphasis, but it sounds like, and it is, $70 million is a lot of money, but let me explain kind of how we got there if I could give a little background. We went through, as you know, the 2003 PERS reforms, and the result of those reforms were a reduction in the number of people's benefits, in other words, a creation of a large overpayment on our part because we were following the direction of the law until the Supreme Court said it would be otherwise. The point there is, in 05, 06, we recognized a large amount of overpayments that we had to collect. We then tried to collect that on the future benefits of members. In other words, as a reduction of the benefits going forward rather than having them write a check to us in one fell swoop. That effort on our part was challenged again in court, and we worked through until about 2008 or 9, I think, before finally the courts, again at the Supreme Court level, said, yeah, you can recover overpayments from the people you overpaid. So the large amount of overpayment that you see represented there, again, I haven't broken it down, but I think predominantly it's going to be this payment plan that we have people on. So it isn't a bad debt. It is a debt that we recognize and have people on payment plans on. It's just most of those people, because it was a reduction in their benefits, we put them on about a 10-year payment plan. So I can break that down more particularly if you want to get into that special area, but I think that's why there's that large number relationship to our agency. It's through that effort, and again, these are benefit reductions, so we know where the payment stream is. We're just taking a little off the top as we go. So the risk of collection is pretty low, generally.
Please follow up.
Well, thank you, Director. And actually, as we go through different agencies, I notice the amount of delinquent debt seems to be going up, up, up every year. You're the positive example. Your debt is going down significantly this year. $43 million you took off the tab in the last 12 months. So I think that's positive news. The question I would like to get some more information on at some point is the fact that you wrote off about $100,000, and I'm interested in hearing how, when we have payment plans in place, that we still cancel some of the debt we've got. But I'll give you the opportunity to look into that and get back to us a little later.
I can tell you, Co-Chair Smith, Representative Gomberg, some of that's going to be people simply died owing us money, and we will go through the estate process and try to collect if there are any assets. But when we put somebody on a payment plan predicated on their benefit ends when they die.
Oh, Mr. Co-Chair, there's always something.
Yeah, there's always an excuse.
Thank you very much.
So I just want to go back and to their organizational chart and explain something that here is a little different, I think, than other agencies that you see, and that's that box in the lower right. So I grew up, if you will, in PERS through my 15 years there through the policy analysis and compliance section. And one of the things that I thought I wanted to make sure is and emphasize and call out again as accountability is the need to have compliance, audit, and risk as a recognized and substantial part of the agency. As Representative Gomberg's questions have pointed out, and I think as anybody who's looked at the numbers related to PERS can appreciate, we represent large dollars, and we want to make sure that those large dollars are used appropriately and spent appropriately, and there's accountability for the tracking of that and the risk that failing to follow the requirements that we might have could present. So I created this compliance, audit, and risk function, which pulled in the policy analysis and compliance, legal compliance and legal services function of the agency, the audit function of the agency, and then enterprise risk management and risk assessments, because somebody in that large and consequential of an agency should be the watchdog. And the watchdog lives right on our organizational chart and has a responsibility to be looking after the agency's operations, and that we follow all the policies and protocols that we should to comply with the laws that we're required to comply to, and also to manage the risks that we pose in our operations. So that's, again, probably something you don't see in every agency. As the financial nature of PERS, I thought it was important to call that out specifically. So a little background on who is PERS, moving off the organizational chart. So the membership, as we've talked about, is divided between the programs that members participate in, either Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP. OPSERP, so far as you see, is grown to be the largest section or segment of our membership in the right there. That's even though it only sprang into existence in 2004. The turnover in public employment has meant that the new people coming in have replaced most of the people that were already in the system. We also, as I said earlier, cover a large array of public employers. We have the state, local governments, school districts, and independents. And, of course, retired members represent a very large slice of that pie.
Mr. Kutcher, quick question. Sorry, I'm not this sharp, but I'm trying to add up the three on the right to see if they should equal the pie and the membership. What am I?
Oh, Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith. The retired members are all on their own. So the three on the right are just the active members. So they should be, I'm not going to say one-to-one, but they should be state, local government, independent, and school districts.
Okay, so if I add up state, local government, independent, school districts, that's going to equal Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP.
Well, that'd be great. Yeah, it should.
Okay, and then retired members are on their own.
Retired members are on their own,
okay,
sorry.
Thank you, sir.
Right, so we split members into retired, active, and inactive. So active are the ones shown in the different employer groups. Let me talk a little bit about why this pie is sliced up in the way it did, and that has to do with what's called pooling. So by pooling, this is only pertinent to Tier 1 and Tier 2, but employers were able to either elect to have their own experience drive their PERS contribution rate or go in with a bunch of other employers. So school districts have always been pooled in Tier 1 and Tier 2. So all the school districts are looked at as one employer in terms of their experience, their expense, their projected liabilities, et cetera. The state has always, of course, been a large segment of our employer group, but also starting in the early 2000s, there was created what's called the state and local government rate pool. And that pool allowed individual employers to join in with the state. So the state and the local governments that you see, those two slices, are the pool of state and local, the local government employers that join the state in that pool. Independents are cities, counties, districts, et cetera, that have chosen to stay outside of the pool and only have their own experience on which their contribution rates are based. So it's a completely at the election of the employer as far as whether they go into a pool or not. And as you see, the large number of local governments have chosen to go into the state and local government rate pool. There's still a few that have decided to ride on their own. That's all pertinent to Tier 1 and Tier 2. For OPSERP, all the employers are pooled. So everybody's experience is shared as far as OPSERP contributions and experience goes. So we took a bit of time a few years ago to define what it is we wanted to be as an agency and what was important to us. And so out of that exercise, we derived our mission statement. And I want to break it down a little bit because it has some very interesting and important components to us as an agency. The first, of course, is we serve the people of Oregon. We recognize that through the good work that we do on behalf, it is done on behalf of the state of Oregon as a state agency. We administer public employee benefit trusts, and trusts is a very important word to us. The work that we do, the funds that we manage, the relationships that we build with our members and our employers are in trust. We have a different fiduciary responsibility to those folks to whom we provide service. And that trust is then a special aspect of how we have responsibility to our membership and how we make sure that we try to focus on the service to them. And then, of course, the last part was just something that came out of the prior director's mouth one day that we had to capture, and that is that we pay the right person the right benefit at the right time. Isn't that what you really want to do? So that is our mission statement. Serving the state of Oregon, administering public employee benefit trusts, often reduced to let's just make sure we pay the right person the right benefit at the right time. Out of that then came our vision, and our shared vision is to honor public service through secure retirement benefits. We want to make sure the benefits we pay are, of course, the right benefits. That's out of the mission statement. But we don't strive for adequacy. We're not a charity. We're not a welfare organization. But we hope that the retirement benefits we pay are secure. And when I talk about honoring public service, that's something that really hit home to me. If you remember a few years back when the Clackamas Town Center had an active shooter. And as I was watching the coverage at home, first I got home and realized that was not the day my wife had decided to go to the mall. And I was relieved at that. But I was watching that coverage and all of those individuals ran into the mall. Those were all people who were members of PERS. Those are all the people that I am trying to provide retirement services to. I think about that when we have things like UCC happen. I think about that as best reflected by a colleague of mine in Missouri who works in their system. He opens every presentation with this overturned vehicle, and all these EMTs are swarming on the vehicle trying to get the driver out and take that person to safety. The last thing you want those people thinking about is their retirement. You want them to be assured that someone has their back as to their retirement benefits, and that is the work that we do in our agency. And whatever public servant you talk about, we want them to be able to focus on their chief responsibility as a public servant in the state of Oregon and know that we have their back as far as their retirement security goes. So that is the vision that we share in our agency. Our core values are again, not particularly unique, but we go through this exercise with our staff to make sure that the staff creates these values and operating principles, and they reflect the attitude and approach that the staff wants to take to the work that they do as far as what's paramount. So that service focus comes through because we're a member service organization. Accountability comes through. People want to be accountable for their actions and their decisions. They want to make sure that they get the responsibility and the ability to make changes and to improve how we do what we do. Integrity, obviously, is paramount. When you're dealing with billions of dollars and you're telling an individual this is what you're going to get as a retirement benefit, you've got to have the integrity to stand behind that. We want to be professional. We want to be accurate. Judicious is one of my favorite words that came out of this exercise. This was, again, the staff's exercise. They want to make sure that people know that we are judicious in our decision-making and in our approach to how we manage this plan. And then lastly, information security. That wasn't something that actually rose to the prominence until I stepped in and said, okay, but there's one thing we got to make sure stays on that list, and that is information security. So we are at PERS a target-rich environment. I know for every employee in our system, I know what you make, I know who you work for, I know your name and address. When you're in benefit status, I know your bank account. I know your Social Security number. So I want to make sure we have that obviously secured, because that is an environment that is full of opportunity. We want to make sure that we keep it behind the walls and indoors and all the things that has to be locked behind. These aspects of our agency, our mission, our vision, our core values and operating principles are all reflected on this fundamentals map. Now, I gave a hard copy of this to you there at your place because I didn't think you could read it off of the slide, but it's really important to understand the components of the fundamentals map and how they drive what we do with the agency. So you see the mission, vision, and operating principles and core values arrayed across the top. That's the achievement of where we want to be. How we get there is through the goals that we've identified, being a collaborative, having collaborative and transparent leadership, having efficient, effective, and adaptable organization, having an engaged and empowered workforce, having timely and accurate service, and being a trusted and credible agency. Those are the goals we've identified as the things we want to be known by. How we achieve that is through the work that we do in the agency, so that work is arrayed there across the middle. We have our core processes, and then the sub-processes underneath that. So our core processes are not, again, all that different than you might expect from a retirement system. We want to collect contributions, we want to assess eligibility, we want to pay benefits. Those are essentially the six operating processes on the left. We have supporting processes on the right, communication, technology, strategic and operational planning. Those are, again, the back office kinds of things that almost any agency does. So the reason they're illustrated here is because they relate to the measures and how we know we're successful. If you want to achieve those key goals, how do you know you're achieving them? Well, we work in a numbers world, so we want to make sure that our numbers align to those goals. And we want to make sure that our processes are measured so we know if we're successful. So that's where you see the process measures beneath there. And those process measures are then used. You can go on our website and blow this up if you want it a little, if even the hard copy I gave you isn't good enough. But the process measures are then used to determine whether we are being successful in moving our agency forward. So there are some 80 outcome and process measures that we use. And what we do is every quarter we have a review meeting where we look at these measures, see which ones are in red or yellow. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And it tells us where we have to get better. But all of this is in alignment. All of this is meaning that the outcomes that we are trying to achieve will tell us whether we are managing to move the agency forward. So it's what we call our outcome-based management system.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
One of the things that you said you wanted to be known for was being a reliable agency, and I'm trying to look down the road and think about the amount of data that you have, really highly sensitive data, and I'm trying to project how devastating it would be were you to have a data breach. And as far as all the goodwill you would do to try to build people's confidence in you as stewards of their information, I'm trying to get a sense of where there might be some vulnerabilities based on the numerous conversations that you and I have had. You guys have some pretty beefy systems. And what concerns me is if overall legislative policy muscles you into a place where you might not feel as though there were adequate protections, but you go because you're a good executive branch soldier. Help us understand how maintaining the reputation of PERS as a steward of this data hinges on where your data lives and how confident you feel in its firewalls.
Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, as I said, information security is and always has been a core operating principle of our agency. We have therefore been diligent in, and diligence is the word we use, diligent in our efforts to assess our vulnerabilities. So we've had a number of assessments over the years, and when those assessments show those vulnerabilities, we take corrective action. So the most recent of those was about a year ago. We contracted with a company to come in and do a top-to-bottom assessment of our vulnerabilities. The technological piece of our information security was quite sound. They were not able to do any sort of penetration or find any vulnerabilities there. What was really where our weaknesses were in the physical security area and what I would call our social security areas. What are those two pieces? Physical security, our headquarters in Tigard is one of our three main buildings. And we did not have cameras for the exterior of the building. So at any point, someone could have come and broken in to the organization, to the headquarters, and we would not have had any sort of record of that incident. Now we have physical cameras. In our boardroom, we have a boardroom where we hold our board meetings. It is what we consider to be public space. In other words, you don't need any security clearance to get into the boardroom because our board meetings are public. Within that public board meeting, there are data ports. So someone could have brought a laptop in and plugged into a data port. And when I say have access to our network, they would be wired into our network. They would still need passwords. There are still security protocols. But we had not shielded those data ports from somebody trying to use that as a point of access. So there were some physical pieces of security that we needed to fix. The social security aspects of it were more behavioral. And by that I mean, for example, our main threat is not that there's somebody, some Russian hackers that are trying to get into our server farm, because we are well protected for that. Our main threat is that staff will pick up a thumb drive in the parking lot and plug it into their computer to see what's on there. And there's something malicious on that, and it will get into our system. The other thing that this assessment team did was put out a phishing email. And I'm sure you're all aware with what phishing is. The email was not what you hear about, you know, I'm in Jerry and Prince and I need your help to get $20 million. No, what it was an email that came from our help desk, was sent, by all appearances, came from our help desk, said, our email server is down today, you need to log into our old email system. And they had the old screen that was on our old email system, and you were supposed to put in your password and your user ID. We had a 60% pickup rate on that.
60%.
Good.
No, I didn't have a question. I was just smiling about, you know, I've already gotten the $20 million from the Nigerian prince, so nobody else needs apply.
Yeah.
But the 60%
tick up.
Whoa.
Yeah. So what it really demonstrates is that there's no centralized IT service that you know the OSCIO or enterprise level can provide that will stop that vulnerability. That's why information security has to be a function in our agency. Someone has to be responsible for that. I will give you just another example. This presentation that you see today, we had a devil of a time loading on a thumb drive and taking it here. Because when you try to take a file off of our server that has nine-digit social security numbers, can't do it. So because we have some large numbers in our budget presentation, the system doesn't look at what is it a social security number. It's just like, whoa, somebody's trying to take a bunch of numbers off. We're not going to let them do it. So Marjorie had to go to our help desk. Marjorie Taylor, my senior policy director, had to go to our help desk, get special permission, get a special download onto this little thumb drive so I could bring you the presentation today.
Or we could just cut your budget.
Sorry?
Or we could just cut
your
budget.
You could cut our budget. But you can't cut our benefit payments. That's the non-limited piece we talked about. So the point is, Senator Johnson, I'm sorry to pontificate on this so much, but we take this very seriously. We will continue to make this a core operating principle of our agency. We have been exemplary, I think, in our cooperation and coordination with the state CAO's office when this executive order came out in the fall and said, this is going to be an enterprise-level effort. We said, how can we help? And the feedback we've gotten from them is, you guys are ahead of the game. You're doing all the right things. Please keep your efforts going forward. And later, when they have this enterprise solution constructed, we will hook right in with that. But we will always make sure that it is a function and responsibility of our individual agency at all levels to preserve our members' information.
Thank you. Thank you for that very comprehensive answer. And I just think that there's an awful lot sort of moving around in legislative information technology land. I have sat in this room for multiple biennia and fulminated about the state data center. And I just want to make sure that there are no efforts at amalgamation, given your unique stewardship of this priceless and sensitive data, that you get jammed into a situation where in trying to comply, you make yourselves more vulnerable. And I guess I'm just suggesting that there might be low cover in the legislature to fly for you to make sure you don't get stuck somewhere.
Thank you for that. But also we need to recognize, and we do, believe me, that we have one data center sitting in Tigard. And as you have heard in our prior budget presentation, as you'll hear later, in the POPs for this year, we want to be more robust in our data in our disaster recovery and business continuity planning. The state data center can actually offer us many services that will coordinate and assist with that, and we'll talk more about that, I think, on the next day. So moving on, as far as the key goals and the measures, just to note how much alignment there is here with the key performance measures.
Co-chair?
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. I really need to digress on a question. Do you folks do your own bookkeeping and own payroll services, or does DAS handle that for you?
Co-chair Manning, Representative Smith, DAS does our payroll. We obviously provide input, but yeah, we're hooked up with DAS payroll.
What was your decision in deciding to go with DAS or to stay with DAS? Is it just historically been that way?
It's always been that way.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So agency overview, driving alignment. So the point here again is the key goals that we want to achieve, the outcome measures tell us how we are coming in achieving of that. It aligns to our key performance measures, which you provide us. So when we look at things like the key performance measures that says retirements are started within 45 days and their target is 80%, that aligns to our timely benefit payments and having clear, concise communication of expectations. The administrative cost per member aligned to those outcome measures, member to staff ratio, all the things that you tell us you want us to be good at, we've incorporated into our fundamentals map. There are some other KPMs that are not as directly aligned, such as the state employee participation in OSGP, estimates within 30 days, and board best practices. For OSGP and for the estimates, those are measures that we obviously keep on track. They just don't roll up to a key outcome or key goal because they're just a component of what we do. So it is still part of our performance measurements. It's just not something that directly aligns to the key goals that we've identified.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
While you have a consultation, I just want to put, for the benefit of our new folks, a couple of points of emphasis here. There was a time when member benefits were not calculated with a great deal of accuracy, and under Mr. Rodman's leadership, I think that problem is largely rectified. I haven't heard anybody calling to grouse about improper calculations. You'd missed them by a mile in some places, or your predecessors had. And is that remains the fact?
It does remain the fact, Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, and again, we have a measure for that. I can tell you anecdotally, we look at it every quarter.
The other question that I would have is where you say board best practices met. I mean, are you following the public meetings laws? Do you have participation, blah, 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 the standard things that you think with good boardsmanship? One of the old ghosts that's going to dog purrs forever is the perception or the reality of bias in decision-making in days gone by when the overcrediting occurred. And I don't know how, under the rubric of board best practices, you judge whether or not you are fulfilling the level of objectivity that you need to discharge in order to keep in alignment with your actuarial advice and to make sure that the kind of bias that helped dig this hole for us is never present again at the board table.
Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, I think a lot of that is helped by the board composition being 3 out of the 5 completely independent. So they have no vested interest in any outcome related to a decision of theirs. It is only driven by their professional acumen. And I think the history of the last, that's since 2003, I think the history over the last 13, almost 14 years now, if you look at the decisions, the unanimity of the decisions, you're going to see that there hasn't been a lot of division among the board members. And I think part of that is knowing you have to drive to a professional level of support to facilitate that decision, and the representatives that have come from the member and the employer side of things have to recognize the bigger agency drivers rather than any individual constituency. Part of the problem with our prior board was a 12-member board, and everyone had their own little niche. So the person who was representing only this small group would be able to drive for an advantage for that group as opposed to looking at the system overall. So I think proof will show that the current board structure has worked well in that regard. And I can only say that I think the level of professionals that they brought into that board when they came in 2003, it was some of the most amazing people that I had the honor to work with, and they really raised the agency's game.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Dirk, I don't disagree with you one bit on that, but one of the things I've internally struggled with is by limiting the board to simply 3 members, do we have adequate expertise to address the many, many issues that you folks are having to deal with?
Co-Chair Manning, Representative Smith, let me be clear. It's 5 members. 3 of them are independent.
Right.
There's a member rep and an employer rep. So there are 5 members.
And I'm not meaning to take away from all 5, but
yeah,
that is a relatively small board, and the issue, there are multiple issues where maybe additional expertise could be.
And one of the benefits, I think, again, of having the practice that we've had is we take a measured approach to decisions. So by that I mean, for example, anyone who's paid attention knows we're going to look at the assumed rate this summer. People know that because we've been saying all along, we're going to take a look at the assumed rate this summer. So everyone knows it's coming. We have a progress of information that we know will come into that decision. And they will have one board meeting basically to review that information before 2 months later they have a meeting where they need to make a decision. We allow space for input from stakeholders and others into the process, and being that deliberate and clear about and transparent about the work that we do lets those other viewpoints come in when they need to. I also have to say I think we are well served by our actuarial firm and the level of professionalism that they provide. We are quite fortunate to have local talent, meaning they are in a Portland office, that is able to give us that sort of professional support. One of their clients is the Florida system, for example. So they have to fly all the way to Florida to go to their board meetings and their legislative hearings. So we're very lucky to have them local.
And I guess that's a good reminder that, you know, not only do we have five talented members, we also have professional staff, plus we have additional outside resources that assist in helping provide information.
Right.
It's a good reminder.
Representative Marsh.
Oh, thank you. I'm just curious, what is it that makes calculating the monthly benefit challenging? Isn't it just math?
Chair Manning, the biggest challenge we have is not math in terms of the benefit, it is eligibility. And what do I mean by that? Whether a member is in PERS is based on the work they do for public employers. In other words, it is an objective measure based on the number of hours they work. So when I came to work for PERS in 2001, pretty easy. I came into a full-time position. I served my 6 months, and I started into my PERS membership. Then if I work for however long I work, I will have my number of years, hopefully all with PERS, and it will be a pretty easy determination for me. You have people that, for example, serve as substitute teachers. They serve as substitute teachers in three different school districts because they're trying to get as many hours as they can. Accumulatively through those districts, they may get to the 600-hour threshold, and then they become members unbeknownst to any of their employers. So we have to then go back and resolve all that. So when that trigger happens 30 years ago, imagine going back to the employer and saying, did this person work 20 hours that week or 30? Because it often can come down to that sort of a level of eligibility. So the time it takes is mostly in the area of eligibility, service credit, whether, I'll keep harping on schools, whether an individual who worked, let's say, 3 weeks in August gets service credit depends on, are they a 9-month employee or a 12-month employee? When did the school year start? When did it end? For that particular school district. So it can be challenging. And again, that all happens at the end of a career, not as it's going on. So getting to the math, there's only three things: salary, years of service, and a factor. That's pretty easy. Getting that salary, getting those years of service, the eligibility determinations around those are the challenge.
Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, you totally persuaded me. But isn't there any way to collect that information in more real-time circumstances? I mean, to go back 30 years must be incredibly difficult. Is there some way we could change the system so that we don't have to go back 30 years?
Co-Chair Manning, Representative Marsh, we did.
Oh, okay.
In 2004, when I talked about this new technology system that we were awarded, it came live in 2011. One of the features of that is what's called Online Member Services, or OMS. Now that that is online, you can go and look at your records, which are the same records as we have. So if you go and look and you see, wait a minute, they don't have my work that I did for Clackamas School District in 1997. You can call that to our attention. We can contact the school district and we can get that resolved now. So that has been very helpful. The world of data that we were able to bring into our new system has made all of those determinations much easier. The problem, of course, is the legacy, the eligibility and the records that happened before that. Much of it was paper-based. Much of it was on an annual reporting basis instead of every pay period like we get it now. But again, what somebody did in 1985 is going to be relevant to their retirement today.
Thank you.
So, how well do we do as an agency? Again, we use an outcome-based management system, and we look at those measures around our operating and supporting processes, which I already went through with some detail. These outcome and performance measures we look at every quarter, we look at them on a scale of red, yellow, and green. We have assigned targets to each of these measures, and a target, you know, achieving that target is green. Yellow means you maybe are falling short. Red means you've got to pay some attention to that particular problem area. So you look at our most recent performance measure, which is as of the end of the last calendar year. Out of those performance measures, 39 were in green, 20 were yellow, 15 were red. Now, one of the cultural conversations we've had to have in instituting the system is we fix the problem, we don't fix the blame. So when you see a red measure, it is not because somebody's in trouble, it's because there's a problem here we need to fix. So the red measures tell us where we need special attention, and those red measures and the culture around reporting and dealing with them has to be focused on how do we bring it out of the red. You also see the bar chart that shows you how many of our measures have been in green in each quarter. We're trending downward, and that is a concern for us. But that's where you start digging into root causes. So if you look at this downward trend over the last several quarters, you realize July 1 is a big retirement spike for us. So the third quarter numbers are going to go down because a lot of people retire effective July 1. So some of the other ancillary work that does around that is going to get dragged down. And so you don't want to dismiss this sort of a trend, but by measuring what you measure and by looking at the actual results, you can understand why something may or may not be trending in the right direction. So this is driven toward understanding and assessing our performance. And then correcting what we need to correct or writing through what we need to write through, because sometimes it's just a temporary problem that will work its way out of the system. So you don't want to overreact either. What this assessment lets us do, though, is set our budget priorities. So, for example, this is how we look at the measures when we do our quarterly target review and our trend lines. Our benefit administration cost per member trended up in 2016, and that was a major concern to us, so we wanted to understand the diagnosis of why our costs went up in that year and what we could do to bring them down. Service interruptions. Those service interruptions mean are we have our technology system that is supposed to be running during business hours, operating hours, 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. We still have to bring our computer system down at 10 p.m. every night to run batch. Because although we have a relatively modern system relative to other agencies, it is technology that was built and designed in early 2000. So a lot of our efforts are around technological upgrades and updates. So you see that service interruption is when during that normal operating window our system's not available. Do we have to bring them down early because we're going to do a deployment? Did we have the system become unavailable during the course of a day? That's what we measure. And you see we had a trend for quite a number of quarters where we were in the red or bouncing around in the red. Now, the tolerance on that is very small. Only 4 or 5 interruptions will get you into the red over the course of a month. But those are 4 or 5 times when members can't get onto their online member services, where employers can't do their reporting, so we take these interruptions seriously. This is, again, the kind of measure that then leads us to think, what's the problem here? The problem, as we understand it, is our technology modernization, which leads to a policy package you will see when we talk about our policy packages in emphasis of technology modernization. So these results are actually what we track to know that we are looking for our efforts in the right places. Not everything we do is driven, of course, by the budget process, but everything we do should be driven by a strategic plan. So we developed a strategic plan starting in 2015. We're in the midst of it right now. And these were the different focus areas that we identified for work under our strategic plan. In other words, these are, over the next 5 years, where we want to get better.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Kutcher. How do you manage member disputes if you come to an impasse?
Co-Chair Manning, Representative Smith. So we have an administrative review process that is common for all agencies.
That's the tool you
use? That's a process we follow, yes. So members can generally, they get a determination from our staff that gets appealed to an executive. That executive reviews the information and either upholds or reverses the members, staff's determination. That can then get challenged to a contested case with an administrative law judge, and then, as you probably know, that can get appealed to the Court of Appeals.
Got it. Okay.
So we follow that process.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Kutcher.
So back to our strategic plan, we broke it into four different areas: organizational management and development, basically an inward focus on how can we get better as an organization, workforce development, organizational communication, and further refinement and expansion of that outcome-based management system. Focusing in member services and communication, we want to talk about quality delivery methods and member relations. In data reliability, we want to talk about member accountability. Representative Marsh, that goes back to your point. You, as an individual, are the best judge of whether we have the right data. So how do we get you, as an individual, to look at your data, to understand it's something that you have responsibility for, and to give us the information ahead of time? That's the idea wrapped up in that member accountability piece. Data constancy, this is another one of our challenges, in that employers, in dealing with old data, or it's because the data we're dealing with can be so old, they change it sometimes. And sometimes they change it after the members are already retired. And when they come back and tell us this person didn't really work from this day to that day, they worked from this day to that day, and that has an effect on their retirement benefit, we change the benefit because we pay the right person the right benefit at the right time. Representative Smith, back to your point on member disputes, does that often lead to one? Yes, it does. But wouldn't it be great if, once members take an action based on their record as of that point, that stays static. That's something we're trying to build to. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we want to improve our data warehouse because we have so much data, we want to make sure it's accessible to all of us in all the different forms and functions that we need. In IT, we want to improve our governance and management. We want to have an agile system technology, focus again on information security and disaster recovery. So these are all the things we are putting in our priority as an agency. Some of these you will see as themes that come through in our budget requests, but again, not all. So we have a policy package we'll talk more about tomorrow related to cybersecurity, another one that's related to our individual account program administration. Lastly, one that talks about business modernization. All of those are links back to pieces of our strategic plan. But let's talk about some of our other goals and tell you again what we're trying to do as an agency. So in the area of data reliability, we want to establish members in this member accountability piece. We want to establish members as that primary quality checkpoint on their data of record. PERS has been through an evolution in member benefits to where we are now predominantly a formula system. So Representative Marsh, as you said, it's just math, right? You take three things, you multiply them together, that gives you a benefit. And so in the old days, meaning like before the 2003 PERS reforms, we were a money match system. As I talked about before, money match is based on your account balance. So all you had to worry about is how much is in my account. Didn't matter how it got there, didn't matter what the records were that led to it. All it was, am I 58 years old and how much money do I have in my account? Now, we have three factors to worry about. We have years of service, a statutory factor, and salary. So now, whether that individual got that month of service with that school district matters. Mm-hmm. Now, was that salary paid to me for this month, or was it paid to me in this month for that month? That matters. So eligibility is being driven by, and benefit amounts are being driven by those factors of data. Again, the member's got to be the one in the best position to verify that data. So we need to change that awareness and appreciation of that data on our member's case so that they recognize their accountability and responsibility for that. The percentage of retirements there shows you in that graph at the bottom how we have flipped from a money match system. That's that blue line. So from 96, out till about 2010, that was a predominant method of retirement. Now we are a full formula system predominantly. And that trend line of the money match going downward will continue. The gray line of full formula going up will continue. And therefore, again, predominantly we are data-driven, not account-based driven. So data constancy, I talked a little bit about this. We want to make sure the data remains static after it's being used in a transaction or payment. We want to lock data for a calendar year and then lock previously submitted data. This is work we do in relationship with our employers, because employers are the ones that have to, of course, pay the consequence for this. If they, by that I mean, if they inaccurately report a salary or years of time of service, hours of service, we're going to charge that employer for that cost, as we do through the normal course of our employer billing. So if they go back and change that reporting, they're going to either be billed for the extra benefits that change created, contributions that are needed, and then also earnings on those contributions are going to be owed by the employer. So data constancy is something we want to build as an expectation with our employers, as well as giving our members some certainty as to when they leave or set up a transaction with us, that they can rest assured that's the end of the changes that they're going to have to experience. I will only tell you, I have been in the position of calling somebody at their retirement party and saying, yeah, not so much. Because...
See you Monday.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a bummer.
Yeah, it is. But again, I'll make a plug into this, Representative Smith, back to your point about member disputes. We recognize that that's completely disruptive to an individual like that. We work as well as we can within the constraints of the law to make sure we can work that person through. So, for example, we said, can't you just be on vacation for the next 2 weeks? Because that will get you, instead of the cash out you're getting, that'll get you the service time you need, and you can go ahead into retirement as you planned. So anyway, we work very carefully with members in trying to resolve those situations.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So colleagues, just the reason I asked that question is, as Senator Johnson brought up, in years past, there were some real discrepancies and real constituent issues that each of us in this body had to deal with. One of the reasons I asked that question is I haven't heard from a constituent in, gosh, I'm going to go 3 or 4 terms as it relates to the good work you folks are doing. And so I was trying to figure out, is there another methodology to where I might have heard what was going on? And yeah, there is another way, and I still haven't heard of any problems. So, and so I think that really says a lot about what you're doing.
Thank you.
That was the purpose for that question.
Thank you. So another one of our strategic plan goals, and this is one that is some more of a preview of discussions rather than something you'll see this session, but the nature of PERS, as I've said, has changed. If I go back, to this chart real quickly, and you know those money match retirements that were predominant, those money match retirements were when we were paying people at 100% of their final average salary. In other words, you made as much money when you walked out and retired as you did when you were working. Those days are long gone as a system level. And as you see with these trend lines, we're trending more closely down to a full formula system. And that means that that those large outsized benefits where people could walk out from work one day and not lose any of their income are gone. What that means, though, is that people have to understand, by people I mean our members, they have to understand their responsibility in taking ownership of some of their retirement savings. And consequently, we talk about a three-legged stool of PERS benefits, Social Security, and personal savings. Members are not, if you walked into your job and you talked to the guy you're replacing and the person you're replacing talked about what a great PERS benefit they're going to get, you're not going to get that. You're not going to get that. And the earlier we can get to our members so that they understand that and how we can roll in this responsibility they have for saving on their own to supplement their retirement, the better off they're going to be. Because if I could get a 25-year-old to put $50 a month into the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, that's a lot more effective for that 25-year-old than it is the 55-year-old. So this is a particular point of emphasis for us as we try to turn our agency and our capabilities. And again, this is something we're working on internally. There's not necessarily something you'll see through the budget cycle of this, but hopefully you'll see something very different in the look and feel of PERS as we evolve into this model. For the people that are within a year of retiring and trying to make a decision, we are great. We have resources abounding for them as far as estimates and application processes and counseling sessions and all those things that will help make that decision better. We are lousy at giving a 25-year-old or a 30-year-old what he or she needs to know about their retirement, and that's where we got to get much better. So, you know, we are taking steps in that regard, and that is the direction we're trying to head. So where does this leave us? We are doing a lot more with, as you'll see, just about the same resources. Retirements have trended down a little bit. Withdrawals are pretty even. Eligibility reviews trending down a little bit. Phone calls are up. Emails jumped to 2015 because that was a legislative session. And benefit estimates are trending up, and online benefit estimates are really jumping. And that's, again, viewing our success in driving people to their online services, because whereas if you want a written benefit estimate from us, you have to give us that request, we have to research your eligibility, pull that information all together, spit out a letter. If we try to get that done within 30 days of the request, but it can take a while to get that processed, you can go online and do almost as well instantaneously. And whereas you can get two of those a year from us without any cost, like what does my retirement look like January 1 of 2018 versus July 1 of 2018, you can put any number of scenarios in online and get as many different scenarios as you'd like to work out. So as you see, we're having some success in driving people in that direction. Just a quick review of some of the budget note reports that we were asked to provide in this biennium. There was a request that we report on change to the assumed rate. So the assumed rate is what the PERS board sets based on the asset allocation that the Oregon Investment Council sets for what we expect the PERS portfolio to earn over the next 20 years. We look at that every 2 years. So at the February 2016 meeting of the General Government Subcommittee, we reported on our July 2015 action, which reduced the assumed rate from 7.75 to 7.5. That rate will get reviewed again in this summer and be decided on again in July of 2015. What is driving that decision? We are, as my colleague in the investment division, John Chervam, says, PERS are. We are investment takers. We are not investment makers. By that, he means his staff does the best job of harvesting the returns that are available across the different asset classes to which we are invested, but we don't make the economy grow. We don't make fiscal policy. That's all done by Janet Yellen, Donald Trump, Paul Ryan, people who drive those actual decisions. The point of that is, when we look at the assumed rate, we're looking at the global, the overall investment environment. And you all know, if you've paid any attention, that that investment environment has been persistently low returns over a protracted period of time since the 2008 market. So market correction. So when you look at the next 20 years, we're still dragging this tail of a low rate environment that has extended longer than I think anybody expected it to. So over 20 years, that's what's going to drive down or put pressure on driving down this assumed rate, because that low return environment persists. Maybe 10 years from now, we'll be back to normal, 15 or 20, but for quite a while in this current 20-year cycle, we're still looking at that lower return expectation. We were asked to identify recommendations for simplifying and reducing the cost of the benefit structure and administration, so we submitted a report on that. And then we were supposed to report on our disaster recovery and business continuity, which again we did at the February 16 meeting. And as a result of that, we continue to make efforts to improve in those areas. Information security. Senator Johnson prompted me to cover much of what I was going to say about this topic. But basically, again, we had an assessment that's about a year old, and then we reported on that assessment. The DAS chief information, DAS and the Chief Information Office and Legislative Fiscal Office all reviewed that assessment, came up with a set of directives to us that they wanted us to accomplish in this biennium for corrective actions. We are working through those corrective actions. Complying with that directive, of course, was our top priority. So the remediation actions that we undertook are well underway. We hired an outside contractor to help us organize the assessment through that process, and that engagement has been on time and on budget and will be resolved by the end of substantively by the end of March into this month. So when we engage with LFO as far as that the needs for information security going forward, we will have the background and information that we need to support those requests. And again, we embarked on this ahead of other agencies who are now trying to work in compliance with this executive order that came out in September of 2016. And I've been assured and will continue to make sure that we stay in close connection with the CIO's office and proceeding down a path that they think is prudent and productive and coordinating with their ultimate solution when they come to land on that. I just give you a brief timeline here of what those activities are that HP Enterprise Services has brought in for us, just so you can see that we this is an incremental approach, and we're moving through all of these different assessments, and again, having completed by the end of March. Lastly, just to cover some key legislation, it's been a busy session. February was PERS month in Senate workforce pretty much, and March is continuing in that same vein. So there is quite a bit of discussion around what changes can be made to the system. Although this was a system conversation, the system conversation was yesterday, it does impact our budget and in our ability to proceed with some of our budget priorities and some of our capabilities. So I gave you some of the more prominent legislation and ideas that are around. These discussions continue, and we continue to try to support and inform the decisions you need to make.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and I appreciate this. This probably isn't the committee for this conversation, but I just want to take 30 seconds on this. Has the PERS board brought forward to legislative leadership their ideas on what could be brought forward as possible ideas to manage the situation before us?
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, no, they haven't, because to do so, the earlier conversation about what is the proper role of the PERS board and where did they get in trouble. Where they got in trouble was they were not respective of their role in not addressing the benefits. The benefits are the province of the legislature. Now, what the PERS board has absolutely done is given us a staff direction and support to give you the information you need to make that assessment.
So Mr. Chair, part of the challenge is you've got 90 citizen legislators who are all good folks in their own right, who are doing what's best in their own right. and I don't mean to insult any one of us in this environment, but I've yet to meet one of us, including myself, that's an expert on how to resolve a $21.5 billion per shortfall. And so I'm trying to figure out, and I imagine 89 other people are as well, is who's going to provide that counsel from on high to us to say, here are suggestions that can help you manage the situation before you. Where's that coming from? Where's Mount Sinai for us?
Well, Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, I wish there was a silver bullet that we could help you with. And the challenge, of course, is the magnitude of the problem, but also the imposition of the Supreme Court's decision that says you can't go back. So as I've said in other contexts, this $21.8 billion problem everyone talks about, you cannot pass a law to fix that. All you can do is look at what changes you might want to make prospectively to reduce the ongoing costs of burdens.
To manage it
going forward.
Right.
And in doing so, understand the only way to save money is to reduce benefits. So I can absolutely appreciate.
Let's push pause on that. What if the goal is not to save money? Hang with me, Rep. But what if the goal is to manage the issue before us? Mm-hmm. Could this body? What would you think if this body created its own additional task force or its own additional professional board that could provide insight to the legislature on how to manage, not reduce, but to manage the issue before us?
Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, I think first off I'd say that's a lot of the work Senate Workforce has done. They've put a lot of effort and time into trying to understand the nature of this problem. And we have tried, and not only we, but they've brought in other people as well to talk about different aspects of managing the problem. If there were a subgroup to look at that, we'd be happy to provide any sort of support and assistance we could. I think it would be, I'm always happy to talk about PERS. So I understand it's a huge problem to try to get your brains around, and it's also a huge problem if you don't focus on it in particular. I can absolutely appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need to think about this more. Thank you.
So that is, coincidentally, the end of the presentation for the day. So unless there are other questions that you'd like me to address today, we'll be back tomorrow.
Any questions from the committee? Mr. Co-Chair?
No, sir.
Staff? Well, I want to apologize for my tardiness today. I had to do my first bill that I got through. I had to do some testimony, make sure I was there to support it, since it was my first bill. Looks like it's going to do good. So I guess we will be adjourning and reconvene tomorrow at 1500 hours, 3:00 for civilians, and we are adjourned. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. We are adjourned.